16 or 35 millimeters?
35.
Because I know that for the academy itself, you should talk to...
There's a kinship there, because, you know, Japanese are supposed to have a green thumb. In fact, you know, when I go to some of these parties and these hostesses that I'm meeting for the first time, immediately, you know, want to get gardening advice from me. How do I... Little do they know, all I have to do is look at a plant and it promptly dies on me. I'm a disgrace to my race.
What is this interview coming up tonight?
What interview? I don't know what it is. I just got a letter from Entertainment. I did, you know, about an hour interview with for them. And they aired it, aired two different segments. They lifted pieces out of that conversation and they've used it already, but apparently they're going to do something else because...
Last year, the Film Society had a convention at the Sheraton in October, and we've got about, 7 minutes of coverage on Entertainment Night tonight, the following evening. It was wonderful. This is the thing I was telling you about in October, which maybe we could talk about a little later. He and I are going to meet again this summer in Kansas City. He's the guest of honor at what is called the KCCon.
Has a convention there.
Fans and, you know, all the whole thing out there in Kansas City.
Weekend of Bacchanalia.
Absolutely. Oh, I've been hearing about the Bacchanalia Suite or something like this.
Oh,
have
really?
You heard about this? Yes, it's been officially designated now. And there will be apparently...
The Bacchanalia Suite.
Yes. I don't know if that means that's where you will be or where Kay and Kathy will be. I'm not sure. Maybe a combination.
Yeah, it's really an incredible phenomenon, this thing called Star Trek conventions. They show the start for the old television episodes, 24 hours for a weekend. And you can walk in there at 3:30 in the evening, at night, and there'll be bodies lying around watching it. I am, you know, when I first saw one of those, I was absolutely flabbergasted. And then they have another ballroom filled with what we call hucksters, people who are selling memorabilias or trinkets that they've made related to Star Trek. And there are people that come with bagfuls of money and buy them. I saw model phaser gun that had some mechanical things in it where it flashed and it made tweeting sounds. Oh, you're recording already. That sold for $750. He was selling these phaser guns for $750. And I think he sold three during that weekend. It's absolutely incredible. I went to one of my earlier conventions. Jimmy Doohan brought one of his old scripts, and he auctioned that off, and that brought $150. I was just aghast.
Have you kept some scripts
particularly
yourself?
Particularly because what I had done with my scripts was, you know, after the episode was done, I just piled it up beside my desk. And when I'm paying bills and I need scratch paper to do some addition on, I would just tear out a sheet, you know, on the back side, do my addition, crumple it up, and drop it in the wastebasket. Or when my little baby niece or nephew would drop over, I'd give him a whole script and have him draw pictures for Uncle George on the back side, you know. So a small fortune passed through my wastebasket. And little did I realize that until that convention when Jimmy Doohan's script went for $150.
You must meet people at those conventions that know the scripts backwards and forwards.
Absolutely. They're like opera buffs who know the libretto. They can mouth the words.
Does that ever become embarrassing when they ask you questions that you say, oh, I don't know?
No. From the beginning, I preface my talks by saying, I just work there. The real experts, the authorities, are out there. You, out there, seated. You're the ones that are going to tell me what we did. And, you know, my memory isn't that good, and you've been watching it and studying it and as if, you know, you're preparing a master's thesis. So I just, you know, up front say, I'm not the expert. You're the authorities out there. And that gets me off the hook right off.
I thought we could stay with the fan phenomenon here for a while. What have been some of the more startling moments that you've encountered at some of these conventions or related activities?
Startling.
Or embarrassing.
Embarrassing.
Even,
or shocking. Or somehow, well, revealing. You know, it's very gratifying to have that kind of enthusiastic support and following. But you meet some people where, you know, you wish that Star Trek could have been a vehicle to broaden their lives, to give them a bigger vision of what life can be. Rather empty lives that they fill with this kind of almost a religious dedication to Star Trek, you know. And Star Trek really, if they really understood Star Trek, the message that we were trying to get out, and here, you know, sounding a little pompous and all that, but what we really were saying is life is a very brief journey, and it's what you do, how you fill in that period, that makes that span of time meaningful. And, you know, all that that's out there can just be there, and you know, it's like, you know, does the sound of the forest, the tree falling in the forest, exist if no one hears it? You know, it's all out there. You've got to get out there and experience it, involve yourself with it, try to derive some lessons out of the experiences that you have, and that way you enrich your life, and hopefully that'll have a ripple effect and enrich others. But, you know, that was the thing that I found a little sad. There are so many people that have such empty lives that they fill in such a narrow way by this kind of dedication to Star Trek. And then there are others that, you know, it's so exciting, the energy that they bring and the joy that they bring. And then, you know, for example, this guy, you know, obviously an entrepreneur who took the phaser gun idea and started reproducing them in really amazing. They're far better than the props that we use. You know, it had real weight. It had this mechanism, the beeping sound and so forth, and selling it for $750 and making a good, profit in that. So, you know, it attracted the entrepreneurial, and certainly these people that organize conventions have a good entrepreneurial streak in them, but also they have this wonderful social, you know, aspect to them. I suppose it's also political, too, in that sense. They've got to deal with a lot of people with their opinions and vested interests. So there are these exciting people, the activists, the doers, you know, that you come across. So it's the whole gamut, I suppose, on second thought, that you meet. You know, you really meet an exciting range of people in Star Trek. I guess I was most taken aback by, you know, some of the sadder people that are involved.
What are some of the things that you yourself have retained from your work on this series or in the films? I mean, do you ever take things with you, like props or anything like that?
Oh, you mean physical things? Mm-hmm. What I've gotten from this series is much more profound than just, you know, things.
Yeah.
I think Star Trek has changed my life in many, many respects. Certainly, I think my career is identified with that more than with any of the work that I've done, although I'd like to think there are other works that I've done that I'm proud of and wish that I could be, you know, identified with.
Well, touching on that, too, I was wondering if the Japanese nationality had something to do originally with the character of Sulu. Or was it more accidental that Sulu was not necessarily intended to be any particular nationality in the first
place? No. Gene very consciously wanted a pluralistic look.
Yeah.
Earth people plus one Vulcan. So it was, I guess, galactically miscegenated as well. but he was very consciously trying to get that kind of look. That the spaceship Earth concept, that we're all in this together. You know, this was in the 1960s, mid-60s, when the civil rights issue was tearing the country apart. But somehow on television it wasn't being reflected at all. You know, it was a very bland kind of television. Star Trek, I think, was one of the few shows that dealt with the fact of the existence of a pluralistic society and that we're inextricably interwoven with each other. Unless we work together and unless we're able to work in concert to overcome a common, you know, adversary, then we're all jeopardized.
as far as your character goes, as distinguished from some of the other ones, quite apart from nationality. Now, Kay and Kathy told me to especially ask you about this. On the shows, you're famous for having lots of hobbies.
Mm.
Is this a reflection of you, your
life at all? I suppose so.
Are you
so.
A dabbler in things? Or
well,
what?
You know, I design my furniture. I'm, you know, I serve on the board of directors of the Transit District, of all things. You know, things. We run the bus line here, as well as we're planning a subway system underneath Wilshire Boulevard that you just came down. I'm involved in the political arena, and we're gearing up for Mayor Bradley's gubernatorial campaign. I'm heading up this fine arts committee to place works of fine arts in the public spaces that's being created by the revitalization.
But no exhibitions of swordsmanship anywhere.
I'm a dedicated runner. I competed in a 10K run. Came in 45 minutes and 27 seconds yesterday. And I'll be running in the Jimmy Stewart. That's a marathon next Sunday at Griffith Park. But actually, it's not a real marathon. It's a team marathon. So we all take 5-mile increments. There are five guys involved in the team. And the last guy runs the 6 miles that makes up the 26 mile.
Are you run. The last guy?
No. I'm going to be the third guy,
oh,
the middleman.
Well,
so I am, you know, I do have a wide range of interests, yeah. And I suppose that was a reflection of my character in some respects. But the other thing that I think was important with the character of Sulu with regard to his ethnicity, Sulu was obviously Asian by the fact that I played him, but he wasn't, boringly chauvinistic about his ethnicity. He was truly a 23rd century person because his name was kind of Asian, but not really identifiably anything.
Yes, it's such an interesting name, too.
Well, actually,
while we're at that.
Initially, the idea was a black actor playing that part. And it wasn't until after Gene interviewed me that he said, you know, why not? Yeah. And then after I started playing it, we discovered that there's a Sulu Seas east of the Philippines. So,
well,
serendipity.
Not?
But, you know, I spoke without an accent. I was a top-notch professional and certainly proud of my cultural heritage, but not totally ensconced in that. My character wasn't totally defined by that. For example, when I go into this swordsmanship thing, it's not a Japanese samurai sword. It's a French fencing foil. You know, he's really a man of the world. And his interests span all cultures. He's not, you know, defined. Whereas Chekhov was Russian and chauvinistically Russian and a little kind of unbelievable in that context. We're the 23rd century.
Well, I always wondered where Scotty got his
exactly,
accent.
And that accent.
And those where in the world?
the point that my character was making was made, I think, is made even by me today. You know, there is this wonderful and rich intercultural moving about now. I look Japanese. My great-grandfather would never have dreamed that his great-grandson would have an Anglo-Saxon first name attached to his surname. As a matter of fact, my father was an Anglophile and a lover of, you know, English history and English literature and so forth. And when he was naming me, he was trying to decide between a king and a prime minister. And I was in danger of being Neville Takei, which I would never. Thank God my father went the kingly route.
Now, when you pronounce it, you say Takei.
Takei, right.
Okay, so there's a definite accent on the second syllable.
Yes, and it's K, not Kai, as
right.
Most people want to pronounce it. You know, they want to give it the Germanic EI.
Uh-huh.
But if you speak Spanish or any of the Mediterranean languages, E is given the E sound. And I is given the E sound, Takei.
During World War II, did you become at all involved in the internment?
I was a little baby.
Process.
I was born in 40,
uh-huh.
And so I was a tiny little baby. But yes, I did spend my boyhood in those camps. I was born here in Los Angeles, And relocations, they call it, happened almost immediately. We were initially put in a temporary area, a camp created temporarily at the racetracks at Santa Anita here. And from there, we were taken to a camp in the swamps of Arkansas, rural Arkansas. And it was there that my mother did a bold and extraordinary thing. She renounced her citizenship. My uncle, on the one hand, volunteered to fight in the United States Army, and my mother felt here she was taking her children behind barbed wires with American soldiers, the country of which she's a citizen, pointing rifles at us and taking her children behind barbed wire, not knowing whether we're going to be there for the next 3 months or for the rest of our lives. Is she condemning, you know, her children to living behind barbed wire like criminals for that length of time, or whatever length of time?
Did all of that happen when you were too young to really have formed any attitudes about it?
Well, I was
it?
Very, very young. So, you know, for me, it was, my parents told us we were going for a long vacation in the country. And I was, you know, actually my real memories, you know, tromping through the swamp, was good fun for a kid. But I do remember the tension and the anxiety with each of the moves and the women crying. And I remember, you know, waking up in the middle of the night and my parents and a few of their friends, you know, with a tiny little light on in the corner, talking, and my mother would be crying. And I guess that's when she was discussing the renunciation of her citizenship. And my father tried to talk her out of that, but he said that, you know, she was a willful woman, couldn't control her then, and couldn't control, you know. Anyway, she went through with that. And because she did renounce her citizenship, she had to, by virtue of that act, by that act, she had to be put in what they called a hardcore camp, which was in Northern California, which meant that the family would have to be separated. My father didn't want that to happen, so he voluntarily, although he retained his citizenship, he voluntarily went with my mother to the hardcore camp, and of course the children went there. I was oblivious of all this, you know, while it was happening. And it wasn't until I was much older that I appreciated the anguish that
there must have been a point at which you had to kind of confront maybe some anger within yourself.
Well, this was after the camp, the whole camp thing was over.
Yeah.
And of course, my mother's citizenship was reinstated, because that literally was a decision made with a gun pointed at her, you know, not at her head, but it was pointed at her. And she was reacting to that. And I'm really actually very proud of the way she reacted to that. I think it was a very American reaction to a very un-American act on the part of our government.
Are your parents still living?
My mother is alive. My father passed away in 79. And to meet my mother today, that sweet little old lady, you wouldn't think was that kind of fiery activist that I'm told she was. But I really am proud of that act that she did. As a matter of fact, there was a series of hearings held in the United all across the United States last year.
Yes, I was going to ask you your reaction.
I did testify. As a matter of fact, I have the transcript for that. You might be interested in seeing it. It's not very long. I have it downstairs. Well, I'll get it later.
I can turn this off.
Well, no, we can continue talking. I can retrieve it later. But I did testify at that. And I kind of capsulized essentially what I told you, the fact that I was a child then. And my real memories actually are you know, fond boyhood memories. But it's my understanding of it after that, and my feeling that it was a lesson about our system of government that we learned as a nation, not just, you know, the Japanese Americans in that case were victimized, but in a larger sense, it was the ideals of this country that was most damaged. And unless we learned that lesson from that experience, then we might repeat that again. And that's why we've got to remember, you know, our history with all of its glory as well as its blemishes, and this was one of the darker aspects of American history.
Yeah, well, you just answered my next question, and obviously you're in favor of having this thing threshed out and all, as much information.
Well, I don't think we really have any choices. Are we going to say we're not in favor of knowing our history?
Yeah.
Are we, you know, going to get a censored history of our country? I mean, that's the most dishonest and ultimately the most destructive thing we can do. I maintain that our system is strong enough and resilient enough, and the ideals are noble enough that we've got to keep it that way. And if once we start censoring it or segregating, you know, the parts that we like and the parts of our history that we don't like, we're going to be in real danger.
You know, this is kind of an odd question to ask in relation to what you're saying, but I just wondered if there are anything about the Star Trek episodes that you look upon now that you see as beginning to date.
Beginning to date?
Beginning to date, or...
I don't think so, no.
You know, we were talking about going back and maybe... How do we regard cultural history of the past? Let's say maybe it might look racist to us or sexist or whatever.
Well, in that respect, perhaps maybe there's a little sexism there. You know, there were two pilots made of Star Trek. The first one didn't quite sell, and the second pilot had to be made in order to sell the series. And one of the reasons why the first pilot didn't sell was the fact that the second in command was not Mr. Spock. Mr. Spock was a much more subordinate character. There was a female character named Number One, played by Majel Barrett, who eventually wound up playing Nurse Chapel, the blonde, who was as Number One was wearing a black wig, and consensus was that having a woman as second in command was unbelievable, and you know, that we couldn't have
that. Isn't that interesting? Because we're not talking about a period of time not that long ago.
That's right, 1965. So that's how rapidly our society is changing. But it's also a commentary on Gene Roddenberry. When he put that series together, he was the one that placed that female character as the second in command. And maybe in terms of costume, too, the women were in those miniskirts, you know. I've heard this from my women friends. Well, actually, you know, in Star Trek the Motion Picture, we had a unisex kind of uniform. I didn't like that. I think, you know, there is a difference between men and women, and there should be an appreciation and an acknowledgement of that fact. You know, to dress men and women alike, I think it's crazy.
Well, I felt that way about the costumes too in the film. Though I enjoy the storyline and everything, but I don't like to see everybody wearing the exact same thing. I find it bothers me for 2 hours.
It's dehumanizing, isn't it? Vive la différence, whether it's sex or personality differences or taste. You know, I mean, there you are in purple, kind of a velvet lounge outfit, you know, and here I am this and that. I think it's variety, and that's what Star Trek was saying. You know, it's the diversity that makes life interesting and engaging, and to be and the thing is to make that diversity the basis for enjoyment of each other rather than the basis for hate and inability to work with each other, you know. And that should be also expressed in terms of our clothes, our personality, our lifestyle, you know. And to deprive us of that, and even to deprive us of our sexual differences in terms of our clothing expression, as in Star Trek the Motion Picture, I thought was terrible.
But you ironically, know, the one element of that pilot that could be called a liberated or forward-looking thing, the lady in second in command, was the very thing that was put down.
That's right. And in her place, we got pointy-eared Vulcans. So yeah, it was liberal and progressive in that respect.
Well, in that also in this respect, can you say maybe that it's fair to assume that the Star Trek series will become almost a cultural artifact of the time from which they came, the 60s? I mean, not necessarily a view of the future, but how we thought about the future in the 60s.
I think so. But also, I think there is a timeless quality about that, because it was science fiction, because it wasn't, you know, in terms of dress, rooted in the 60s, the ideas that we toyed with, I think are still pertinent in many respects. The inability for generations to get along with each other, you know, and that at that time that was a burning issue too, you know, the generational divergence in some, you know, the some parents even that killing their progeny, you know, there were some movies made of that, that sort of thing may not happen to that dramatic extreme, but you know that's a perennial issue. The difficulty that generations have to in living with each other and understanding each other, the inability of at that time we may have been dealing specifically with the civil rights crisis, but inability of people to work and live with each other because of superficial physical differences, you know, still exists. Mm-hmm. So I think in that respect, some of the ideas that we dealt with. Will remain universal.
I thought before we moved on into the films, could you give me a very quick a little calendar of dates here? For example, when you began acting in films or television, when you began with the Star Trek series, then how long that lasted, and what films have come along since then?
When I began acting, my mother says I made my theatrical debut in the maternity ward. I've been performing as far back as I can remember, you know, putting on backyard theatricals, grammar school plays I still remember, and I remember going out to see Errol Flynn and Robin Hood and becoming infatuated with that and coming home and having my mother make me the costumes and organizing the neighborhood kids. Oh, it was really...
It's a book I've done on Doug Fairbanks.
Oh, well, what do you know? Oh, we really had an our gang kind of thing. You know, of course, it was my costume. My mother made the costumes, and it was my backyard, so I played Robin Hood. I was a chubby little Japanese boy, you know, so here you had a chubby little Japanese Robin Hood. My maid Marion was Martha Gonzalez. And my Friar Tuck. My Friar Tuck was taller than me and skinnier, Gary McGarry. really was our gang.
Who was the casting director of that?
Oh, project? Me, of course. And I wrote it, and I directed it, and I produced it, and I bossed everybody around. My mother made the costume, and, you know.
And I suppose you went on from there into high school workshops?
High school. Yeah. But, you know, my parents didn't want me to be an actor, and they saw the handwriting on the wall. Not only handwriting, you know, there I was performing at the dinner table now. So they said, well, you're also, you know, interested in architecture, aren't you? And they would subscribe to architectural journals and leave it lying around. And my father would say, you know, there's an interesting building going up downtown. Why don't we go down and look at it? And he would point out things to me and say, so I got the message, you know, and I was a good son. So I started off my college career as an architecture student up at Berkeley. And this was Berkeley in the pre-revolutionary days. We were the panty raid generation.
All right. I remember those.
Oh, we had our values right down to the fundamentals. I mean, we didn't get involved
first,
in free speech and baby speech and all that. We organized and marched up to the sorority houses, you know, in huge hordes and said, we want panties. We want panties. And the girls would peek out the second floor window and bring their little lacy things and tease us with it like this, you know. And one bold, venturesome girl would throw it out, and there'd be a great roar that would go out, and 10 zillion arms would reach up and start pulling at it, and I got a shred, I got a ribbon, I got a lace. And then the chant would go up again, we want more panties. Those are my Berkeley days. Yeah. Before Mario Savio and all that. But I was, you know, an architecture student on paper. I was spending more time in the English department. As a matter of fact, you know, I was a bearded spear carrier in their production of Macbeth.
Well, Robin
hiding behind
spear
a
carriers.
Lot of, you know, beard and hair on the face and all that. And I, you know, I was one of the Scotsmen in the battle sequences of Macbeth there. And I said to myself, this is ridiculous. I've got to be realistic with myself. You know, I'm supposed to be architecture student, but here I am, you know, getting bad grades because, you know, I'm spending all my time masquerading as a Scotsman, carrying spears and all that. And fate also came into play then. I was back in Los Angeles for the summer. My father was in real estate, and one of his associates, a woman, dabbled in theatrical agenting. And at the office, she told my father that they're casting for a Japanese science fiction film that they're importing, and they're wiping out the Japanese dialogue and dubbing in English dialogue.
So that would have been Rodan?
Yes. They were looking for Japanese voices.
Let's see, what date are we talking about on Rodan? 58, 60?
50, it's in the 50s. Okay. 58, thereabouts.
I'll check that 58, 59,
thereabouts.
The picture scared the hell out of me when I first saw it.
Oh, did it really?
I was still young enough that I didn't notice people wearing suits. It looked very real to me.
Well, anyway, my father came home and... over the dinner table, he said, George, you haven't got a summer job yet. Mary was talking about this thing here, and so why don't you try out and see if you can, you know, get a summer job. I tried out for it, and I got the second lead, the scientist with the horn-rimmed glasses.
Okay.
And also you do, you know, 10 dozen other voices, the policeman, the honeymooner.
No wonder somebody the voices sound right.
Oh, that is rough work. I didn't realize, you know, because not only do you do the dialogue, but you also do the crowd noises. And they're, you know.
Mumble.
No. They're panic-stricken, shrieking. Ah! Oh! Or the monster's choking. You know, take after take. You know, right on, you know, and it's got to be synced. You know, each time the man jerks, you go, you know, oh, you come home absolutely raw. You know, throat's just torn to shreds. But I enjoyed it. I was acting, and I was getting paid for it. I was absolutely, you know, swept up by that. And I said to my father, you know, I'm going to have to do something about this. I don't want to, you know, 10 years down the road, after I'm done with architecture and ensconced in some architect's office, you know, sitting at a drafting table, drafting away, being miserable and unhappy and thinking I coulda, I shoulda, I woulda,
taking a shot, you know, at it, yeah.
And I said, I've got to be honest with myself and at least be fair to myself right now. And I'm going to go to New York and enroll at the Actor's Studio. My father said, I knew this conversation would eventually be coming up. And, you know, he saw the way I was coming home from the dubbing sessions, you know. And so he said, well, your mother and I would like you to at least have that sheet of paper that says you're legitimate, you know. They're into the degree thing. And they don't give those degrees at the Actor's Studio. If you go to UCLA, you want to study theater. Study theater there at UCLA and get that degree. You will be subsidized. If you go to New York, you're going to do it all on your own. And New York is a tough place. And, you know, it's you could call, but, you know, this is the bargain, and you make your decision, and we're not going to waver from that decision. We love you and all, but, you know, you're going to make your decision, and you're going to live with it. And I said, well, Dad, let's compromise. All right, you know, you want me to stay in Los Angeles, and I want to go to New York. The Goodman Theater in Chicago is halfway. Can I have at least half subsidy there? And my father said, the subsidy doesn't cross the Los Angeles County line.
About how old were you then? 18,
I was 19 thereabouts, I guess. Uh-huh. And I was old enough to be practical. You know, having lived at Berkeley, you know, you're away from home, and, you know, you do appreciate the check coming in. I made the practical decision. I went to UCLA. And actually, Father knows best in many respects, because, you know, at that time I was infatuated with just the thought of becoming a movie star, you know. When you study theater, the history of the whole rich history of the theater, the aesthetics of the theater, the other kinds of theater, Greek drama, Elizabethan, you know, it really opened up many, many other doors, and I have that to be grateful, you know, I have my father to thank for opening those doors for me. And I, you know, after I got my bachelor's, I eventually got my master's at it as well, because...
Yeah, we seem to be living in a time when more and more actors have a good sense of theatrical history and development. And that maybe didn't used to be the case, but it
That's
seems
right.
to be now.
Well, I guess it happened at a time when, I mean, you know, an earlier generation, actors just fell into it. You know, you were discovered, and you were put on contract, and so you really didn't, you know, have the opportunity. If that had happened to me, you know, if I got a term contract at MGM or something, you know, I probably would have stuck with it, and if if the circumstances weren't there to open up my windows, so to speak, you know, I probably would not have discovered those areas. But, you know, the age of contracts was over, and we had in between engagements plenty of between engagement time, unemployment, you know, that we wanted to fill. And I found, you know, I wanted to fill it that way by continuing my studies for a degree.
By golly, at this time, between that time and the beginning of Star Trek's not that many years. Things must have begun to happen rather quickly for you.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I kind of acted my way through college. I started at UCLA, and but at the dubbing session, which Mary Reeves got for me, was another man, an agent, who was watching the way I, you know, performed, and he came up to me and said, "I'd like to represent you." I said, "Well, I'm going to, you know, be going to UCLA, and besides, you know, Mary Reeves was one who got me this job, and my father knows her and all that, you know." I'm going to be at UCLA. And so, you know, I just left it at that. But I was seen in a student production at UCLA by a casting director at Warner Brothers at that time, Hoyt Bowers, who's now at Paramount. Actually, he's got cancer.
Hmm.
And he's been out for the last few months. It's kind of sad. Because Hoyt's played a important role in my career also. He was the one that saw me in a student production at UCLA and called the UCLA office, theater arts department office, the next morning and said, "You know, you've got this student, George Takei. How can I get in touch with him? You know, would you get a message to him that, you know, Warner Brothers would like to have him call?" And I got that message, called, and they wanted to test me for a movie. And I said, "Well, I better call that agent back. You know, I've heard all those horrible stories about how Hollywood, you know, will get you indentured." So anyway, I went and was interviewed, and they liked me, and they but they wanted to test me because it was this Edna Ferber thing, Ice Palace, mm-hmm. A three-generational thing. And I had to age from like 20 to 80 or something like that, you know. And they wanted to, most of my part was while I was young.
You literally saw your whole life pass before your eyes, right?
Not only saw, I felt it. Oh, that makeup was very painful. Anyway, they wanted to make sure that I could credibly look 60 or whatever, you know, age I aged to. And so I had to make makeup tests. And it was really a lot of fun. You know, they would put you in front of the camera, and the director would ask you questions, and you'd respond to it, and he would say, "Well, now pretend that you're, you know, such and such age," and respond to it in that way, and so forth. Anyway, apparently I passed muster because I got cast. My first picture, and here I was in a film starring Richard Burton, Robert Ryan, Carolyn Jones, Martha Heyer. all big stars of that. Yes, somewhere. And I got a 3-week location trip in Alaska, and this again happened to fall during the summertime, so it was my next summer job. You know, then we shot back at the studio for about 4 months, slopped over into school a little bit. As a matter of fact, I couldn't continue with ROTC because slopped over into, you know, the semester, and I had to quit ROTC, but the theater arts department was understanding, so I was able to straddle both school and work.
Yeah, I had a year of that myself. Were you of draft? I mean, there was a draft.
That's right.
I mean, because I got nailed in 70. Did you ever serve in the service? How did that?
I was taking ROTC so that I could, you know, hold off on that. When I had to drop out of ROTC, I figured I had to, you know, do something to, you know, stay out. So I volunteered for the National Guard, went to take the physical, and I, when I was a child, I had an operation here for a thing called interoception. And shortly after the operation, they sewed me up with the sutures that's supposed to dissolve into my stomach. I got a bad case of cold. I was about, what, a year and a half or whatever. Very, very young. And my stomach didn't have the strength to digest the sutures. And it got rotten and broke up into tiny little pieces. And I had to have an operation on top of the operation to pull out the broken bits of suture. And that operation was one that poked two holes over the scar. It looks like I've got two more belly buttons right here.
I'll be darned.
And under extreme tension or pressure, there's like 1 in 1,000 chance of this bursting. And the National Guard decided they didn't want to take that chance with me. And so they gave me a, not 4F, but, you know, some lower degree.
Are the chances remote enough, though, that, I mean, it's not something you think about?
I mean,
you're so athletic in what you
do. There's really no chance of anything happening, but I guess they just didn't want to take that, and I welcomed that.
Really?
And so, make like Lyndon Johnson.
Good heavens. Take a look. Oh, come on, take a look.
Oh,
he's
Lyndon.
Not kidding. It does look like two actually.
It really does.
Holy mackerel.
These two holes were poked in there too. To pull out the broken sutures.
Look at her sitting demurely over there.
Well, you know, in junior high school, during boys' gym, every semester, when you know, we'd have to shower, to have to explain what these two were. I got so tired of going through that story, I told people, you know, I was just attached to my mother. Very attached to my mother.
Well, now we're at Ice Palace, and we still haven't gotten to Star Trek. How much do we have to cover?
Well, Star Trek came after I graduated, and I'd gotten my master's, too, for that matter. Mm-hmm. You know, I worked my way through college. I did a whole slew of Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers liked my work on Ice Palace, and...
What are some of the other films that you're talking about here? What are some other titles?
I did about a half a dozen Hawaiian Eyes. I did a Maverick, playing a Chinese gold miner. I did Sunset Strip, 77 Sunset Strip. You know, all those, you know, the series that they ground out. They had about, a dozen different series going.
Oh, God. Sugarfoot and...
Yeah.
Follow the Sun and Bourbon Street Beat.
I did Follow the Sun, too. The Follow the Sun wasn't Warner Brothers, though. Follow the Sun was 20th. But it's the same, you know, genre.
Troy Donahue.
Troy Donahue, Diane McBain, Cookie Burns. Jim Garner was about the only one that survived that period.
That's right.
Bob Conrad, Tony Isley, Connie Stevens, you know, the whole... lot there. So I did a whole slew of those. I did, you know, Californians, Adventures in Paradise.
Oh, I remember that.
Oh, do you remember that?
Yes.
There was another one like Adventures in Paradise.
I even remember the theme song to that.
Oh, do you?
Da, 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 da.
Oh, yeah, very good. You're a true buff. Gardner McKay,
yeah.
Who's now a drama critic here in Los Angeles.
Oh, really?
Mm. There was another one like
Richard
The
Long
Islanders.
Was passed on.
That was the MGM version of Adventures in Paradise. So all those, you know. When I graduated, when I got my bachelor's degree, my father did a very sweet thing. Very symbolic. My father likes to deal in symbols, you know. He was the one that was resistant to my studying theater and you know, becoming an actor and all. But when I finally got the bachelor's degree,